The theme for the summer is Lighten Our Darkness, and what I shall be doing during the next several days is contributing more to the darkness than to the light. Because the very title that has been given to this, 19th Century Piety, goes along with what Walt Bowman stated the other evening when he said that so much of our piety does come from the 19th century and is not particularly relevant to the contemporary scene. He made specific reference to our hymns, that they come from the 19th century or earlier, as we have them in the hymn book, and are addressed to conditions that are not necessarily the conditions of our own time. But I think in order for us to attempt to lighten our own time, we need to understand from whence we have come, and to take a look at some of the major motifs of piety that I think, irrespective of our theological confessional stance, nonetheless, to a rather large extent, dominate the pew. It's very difficult to try and ascertain what the pew believes. It's easier to try and describe what the theologians believe. But what does the pew itself actually practice in its religion? And I'm going to suggest during this week that there are a number of major blocks of piety that emerged in the 19th century and still play a very large role on the American religious scene if one looks at that admittedly very elusive character, the man in the pew. And the one that we're going to address this morning is entitled The Gospel of Wealth. I've observed a few people looking at that title and they sort of turned up their nose as if it is all bad. And perhaps from what we were hearing at the Bible study earlier this morning, it is largely all bad. But nonetheless, it's a very dominant theme that we find expressed here on the scene. The Gospel of Wealth, as I intend to describe it to you, emerges in 19th century America, particularly in the industrialization of the country that occurred after the Civil War, when, with the advancement of science, there developed new ways of making wealth. And one of the, I think, most perceptive analyzers of the American scene, and could do so in somewhat of a satirical way, was Mark Twain. In 1873, he, along with another man, published a novel called The Gilded Age, A Tale of Today. And the prime character in this novel is a young man who is appropriately named Philip Sterling. And this is how Twain describes Philip Sterling, a young man then in the first decade after the Civil War, as industrialism becomes a major factor in the American way of life. He was born, says Twain, into a time when all young men of his age caught the fever of speculation and expected to get on in the world by the omission of some of the regular processes which had been appointed from of old, and examples were not wanting to encourage him. He saw people all around him, poor yesterday, rich today, who had come into sudden opulence by some means which they could not have classified among any of the regular occupations of life. I want to look at two Philip Sterlings this morning, both of whom thought that they were exercising Christian stewardship. So the two men that I want to look at, who are proclaimers of the gospel of wealth, are not securing wealth for the sake of securing wealth and then living conspicuously. They are not men like Randolph Hearst, who built his San Simeon as a matter of conspicuous consumption on the California coast. These two are men who gained, one of them who gained wealth personally, one who taught others to gain wealth, but who considered as their primary task the Christian responsibility of the distribution of wealth. The two men that I have in mind are, first of all, Andrew Carnegie, as the gainer of wealth, and the second is a Baptist preacher by the name of Russell Conwell, who was concerned also with gaining wealth, but both men were concerned with what they did with it. Andrew Carnegie often comes off as a villain, but I will come to his defense. Because Carnegie, if you keep this in mind, may have somewhat of a different view of him, insisted that a man ought to be born poor and also ought to die in the same condition. He would not take any money with him, even if he could. Now, we look at Andrew Carnegie. This is sort of the Horatio Alger Jr. story of rags to riches. It's not quite the case. Carnegie was born just north of Edinburgh, Scotland, in Dunfermline, in a moderately well-to-do weaver's family, at a time when the industry was conducted by the employing of apprentices and journeymen and handling the looms in the home. But by the time Carnegie was 10 years of age, the Industrial Revolution had hit into southern Scotland, and the looms were moved to factories, and the family could no longer make a living. So that this middle-income family saw, because of industrialization, its family's resources diminished. And Andrew's parents, for the sake of the two boys, decided that there was no future for them in Scotland. And perhaps Scotland's greatest export has not been its Scotch, but has been its Scotsman, because it has been a country that has had to export many, many people. There simply was no way to make a living in Scotland. So the family came to Pennsylvania following the footsteps of earlier members of the clan. And the family settled down largely without financial resources. In fact, they even had to borrow money to get from Dunfermline to Pennsylvania, because when the family sold the looms, they could not even get enough money for them to pay expenses. So the family is quite impoverished. And before he's 12 years of age, Andrew is working as a bobbin boy in a cotton factory. A couple of years later, he works in the bobbin factory itself. And he's on a very low salary, but he is using whatever money he earns to augment the meager income of the entire family in order that it may survive in this new land. Now, Carnegie is an ambitious sort of fellow. He takes advantage of the opportunity. And he moves from working inside in the bobbin factory to, as a middle teenager, securing a job in a relatively new business, that of the telegraph. And he becomes an errand boy. Now, this was an opportunity, because as an errand boy, personally delivering the telegrams as they came into Pittsburgh, he met all of the prominent people in Pittsburgh. And he took upon himself the obligation of memorizing all the addresses and recalling all the faces so that he knew all the titans of industry in Pittsburgh. But he also realized that there was no future in his life in terms of economic success, just running telegrams. So early in the morning, before the telegraph office would open, he would go down and he learned how to operate the machine, so he could take the messages as well as to deliver them. And if the operator didn't show, Andrew was there to take over the operation of the office. He became noticed by the businessmen, and when the Pennsylvania Railroad opened its first district office in Pittsburgh, the general superintendent of the district hired Andrew Carnegie as his secretary and telegraph operator. One day, however, the general manager didn't get to the office on time, and since the trains were run by telegraph, they were in danger of becoming confused. So Andrew sat in, took the messages and distributed them in the general superintendent's name and ran the railroad. Fortunately, there were no accidents, and the superintendent was very much impressed with him. He then prevailed upon Andrew. He said, if you can find $500, join me in an investment in a transportation company. Andrew went home and convinced his parents to mortgage their home for $500 in order that he might join with his boss in making an investment in the Adams Express Company. The investment proved to be wise, and Andrew, still as a teenager, had the experience of becoming a capitalist and getting dividend checks. And he realized that money can make money without one's own physical labor. And he was enthralled by the idea. From the Adams Express Company, he then moved over into a new industry on the railroad lines, making sleeping cars. It was an investment that also proved to be profitable. And at the right time, he sold his interest in this infant company to a man with the name of George Pullman. Then he became interested in the fact that there were not good bridges for the railroads. And so he invested what little money he had in the Keystone Bridge Company. This introduced Carnegie to what was to be eventually then his life's work, that of the steel industry. By the end of the Civil War, Carnegie resigned from the railroad company and with several friends then launched into the steel industry. And this then became his life's work. And from 1865, into 1901, he developed then the Bessemer process in this country and became the leading manufacturer of steel and iron products. He sold out in 1901, along with his associates, to J.P. Morgan and his associates, J.P. Morgan being the major banker in the United States. And they sold out to J.P. Morgan, who then, with his associates, formed what is today known as United States Steel, for a price that was estimated at that time to have been $492 million. Now, there was no income tax law at this time. So you can only in your mind imagine what a profit of $492 million 1901 dollars would amount to, in terms of the purchasing power of today. Now, how he amassed this enormous amount of wealth leads many questions, I'm sure, in the minds of those who would have a Christian conscience. Carnegie believed in the sacredness of property, and he also believed that God had implanted in America the capitalistic system in which property could be acquired by those whom God had elected to acquire it. Now, Carnegie, of course, coming from Scotland, you would expect to be under the influence of the Calvinist religion, the ideas of predestination and so on. I have not been able to find much evidence that Carnegie was a traditionally religious man. But he seemed very much to be infused with the idea of election. And the one parable that seems to fit is the one that's sort of an in-house joke around here for Friday night vespers. Because for the last two Friday nights, two different women have chosen this text, but neither one of them have given it a Carnegie interpretation. I'll give you his interpretation of it this morning. And that's about the wealthy man who goes into a far country and calls in his servants, and to one he gives 5,000 talents, another 2,000 talents, and the third one 1,000 talent. And they go out during the master's absence, and the one who has 5,000 increases it to 10,000. The one who has 2,000 increases it, or whatever it is, and the one who has one, no. The one who has 10 increases it 10 more, and the one who has 5 increases 5 more, and the one who has 1 simply buries it in the ground, and when the master comes for an accounting, is able to produce only a rusty one. And then Carnegie took great delight in the story, as it is told here in the New Testament, by saying then that God said to those, to the one who had increased the 10 to the 20, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you responsible over even more." And the same was said of the man who had increased from 5 to 10. But the one who only returned the one that he had originally been given was described as being a wicked and slothful servant, to be cast into utter darkness where there'd be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, in Carnegie's way of thought then, given the idea that he believed in the sacredness of property, that he believed in laissez-faire capitalism as God's plan for the development of the good earth in America, Carnegie then said that he was not to be envied, but to be pitied, because he was the man to whom God had entrusted the 10,000. He had exercised proper stewardship and increased it to 20,000, and now, in addition, had been given the rusty 1,000, so that he had 21,000 to continue in his investment policies. Perhaps one could make a caricature of the Old Testament here, too, as Carnegie believed that he was then to have dominion over the resources of America in order that he might develop them. Now, at the same time that Carnegie is pushing this idea, he is also picking up a popularization of Charles Darwin's Survival of the Fittest. Not social Darwinism here at this particular point, but the Darwinism in a rather crude way. And he was not at all hesitant to use the term survival of the fittest in the business world. He preferred that term rather than the term of election. Others who have commented upon him have developed this predestinarian idea. So that he felt that God selected individuals upon whom he placed the responsibility of developing the natural resources according to the laws of laissez-faire capitalism, where the purpose of government was not to ensure the rights of his employees, but to ensure the protection of his property, with the assumption of an automatic harmony type idea, that as he increased the wealth of the country, he would raise the standard of living for all individuals. And this was stewardship. He would say some individuals would be crushed by this process, but that the entire level of society would be raised. And he would say, just look at 1850, 1830, and see how much improvement there has been made in general societal living standards, 1870, 1880, 1890. So he treated his individuals not as servants of God, but he treated them as machines. And so his workers were paid very low wages. He charged very high prices, whatever the market could bear, in order that his profit line could be much greater, in order that he could make more investments. See, his idea was this: God has given me then the ability to make all of this money, to develop all of these resources. God then is expecting me to be a paternalist, which is a favorite term of mine, over against society. I will do for society what society cannot do for itself. I am responsible for the lives of all of these people. Not so much the lives individually, as I am responsible for society and its material advancement. Now, in looking for some kind of a basis for this, he finally came across a quotation, which very likely is taken out of context, but then it suited Carnegie rather well, from a sermon written by John Wesley in the midst of 18th century England industrialization. And after, in 1889, he had published his thoughts in the North American Review under the title Wealth, others began referring to it as the Gospel of Wealth, Carnegie said, I would never have had to have written that article if I had before known of these three paragraphs of John Wesley. And they read, gain all you can by honest industry. Use all possible diligence in your calling. Lose no time. Gain all you can by common sense, by using in your business all the understanding which God has given you. It is amazing to observe how few do this, how men run on in the same dull track with their forefathers. Having gained all you can by honest wisdom and unwearied diligence, the second rule of Christian prudence is, save all you can. Do not throw it away in idle expenses to gratify pride, etc. If you desire to be a good and faithful steward, out of that portion of your Lord's goods which he has for the present lodged in your hands, first provide things needful for yourself, food, raiment, etc., underscore needful. Second, provide these for your wife, your children, your servants, it's an order here, and others who pertain to your household. If then you have an overplus, do good to them that are of the household of faith. If there still be an overplus, do good to all men. Now that is taking it out of Wesley. He himself wrote it in this fashion. This then is held to be the duty of the man of wealth, to set an example of modest, unostentatious living, shunning display or extravagance, to provide moderately for the legitimate wants of those dependent upon him, and after doing so, to consider all surplus revenues which come to him simply as trust funds. Instead of using the word stewardship, he'll use a more monetary economic term, trust funds, which he is called upon to administer, and strictly bound as a matter of duty to administer in the manner which, in his judgment, is best calculated to produce the most beneficial results for the community. The man of wealth thus becoming the mere trustee and agent for his poor brethren, bringing to their service his superior wisdom, experience, and ability to administer, doing for them better than they would or could do for themselves. Now, I don't think Carnegie ever really mentally left Scotland. And he is using words that are very typical of the British Isles. Paternalism, trust funds, the state doing for you what you cannot do for yourself. Very typically English terminology that he is using here. Well, this then is what he says. Earn the money according to the laws of laissez-faire economics. Develop the good earth. Raise the level of all society by imposing upon individuals that which you deem is best for them. And be assured that God has laid upon you the responsibility for doing this. There is an elitism to Carnegie. When we come to Russell Conwell in a moment, I'm going to suggest that there is no elitism there. Conwell expects everyone to gain wealth. Carnegie did not, you see. There would only be the few who would gain real wealth. The rest would be dependent upon the wealthy man. But Conwell, more democratic, more American, expects everyone to gain wealth. Well, precisely what did Carnegie say to do with wealth once one had obtained it? Here is his paternalism coming through. And he lists a number of examples as to what a man should do for the betterment of society as a trustee. One should build universities. And there are those who comment on the late 19th century and say that there was a lot of good old Roman Catholic penance by the robber barons in the establishment of academic institutions. And they refer to John D. Rockefeller's University of Chicago, the Vanderbilt's Vanderbilt, Drew, and you can go on. But Carnegie said, you will come to the time when there will be enough universities established in the country, but all of those that are established will always be able to use more endowments. So he suggested that people give perhaps to existing universities, particularly in the area of the sciences, in order that those, and he seemed to have sort of a soft spot for college teachers, university teachers. And all, in order that those who are so gifted by God, but who are not remunerated by society properly, may enjoy, because of these endowments, the facilities with which to work. And then the second one that he put on his list was really the first, I'm sure, in the public image of Andrew Carnegie, and that is the establishment of libraries. He erected over 2,500 libraries across the British Isles and the United States. The first one in his hometown of Dunfermline, Scotland. And he did not require that his name be put on them. And in some states in this country, the term Carnegie never appears on a library. But in many areas, of course, the name does appear on it. But this was the way he would do this. If the community wanted a library, he would build the building, put the stacks in, and then deed the building to the city. He would provide no books, and he would provide no endowment. It was the community's responsibility then to stock the library and to maintain it. He would never give an endowment. The community then had to prove that it was worthy of this chance for the elevation of its culture. He would give them the means to start the experiment. And his particular delight in libraries was that he had almost no formal education himself, but that a Colonel Anderson in Pittsburgh opened up his private library of 400 books every Saturday afternoon to any boy who was working in the city. And Carnegie there went and read and consumed everything that was in the library, and stated that if he ever reached the point where he had the material resources, he would see to it that boys all across England and America, or the Great Britain and America, would have the opportunity to read books. There's a little bit of this, God helps those who help themselves here. And this is very much behind Carnegie. In addition to libraries, he was very much interested in medicine. Not in curative medicine, but in preventative medicine. A man of wealth ought to endow research hospitals. It's up to the community to take care of those who are ill. But he would give funds for the research medicine. Also, he was a rather poetic individual. He liked to see the establishment of parks. And he bought Pitt and Greif, the estate in Dunfermline, developed it into a park, and turned it over to his hometown. He liked parks, and in the parks he would want lots of flowers, where his employees could get the good air on the one day in seven that they were not working in his dirty factories. Mm-hmm. But he enjoyed parks. And another thing, and this is probably the second thing for which he is most famous, he decried the fact that even in major American cities, there were not the cultural institutions that one could find in even the middle-sized and smaller European cities. He wanted concert halls everywhere, and in every concert hall, a fine organ. And now there's been the musicians in this country have banded together to save the Carnegie Memorial in New York, Carnegie Hall, from destruction. So it's sort of been given a rebirth again. This was what he wanted to find all across America. And then he, with his European background, thought that every community ought to have a public bath. And that's the term that he constantly used, and it's still used in Europe, the public bath. And every child should learn how to swim. Of course, I suppose that's just innate to anyone born in the British Isles, that you learn how to swim. And he thought every child should learn how to swim. So you want every community to provide public baths. Now notice, there's one thing he does not give money toward, and that is to a church. And the reason for that, he says, is that rarely does one find a church that is a community church. It is usually a denominational institution and seeks only really to serve a slice of the society. But if one can find a truly community religious organization that seeks to serve everyone in the community, then he would give money to help them erect an imposing building, but then they would have to develop the programming and maintain it. Now, this is how you would distribute wealth. But remember, this is not done, in Carnegie's terms, by bequest. That's cheating. This must be done during the lifetime, so that the donor sees that the money actually goes to the intended purposes and is used in those purposes as the donor thinks it ought to be used. So, between 1901 and his own death in 1919, he gave away, but that has to be said in quotes because he had administered it when he gave it away, well over $300 million. And he actually, when he died, left his family relatively little. His daughter, his only child, received an estate at her father's death of something less than $19 million. But when you consider it on the basis of $492 million, that's not much that he left, proportionately, to her. But this, then, was his concept of Christian stewardship. He felt that he had a responsibility to provide the opportunity for those who likewise were of the elect to manifest their election. But he had no hesitancy to recognize that vast multitudes were indeed damned. And whether their hell began after death or in this life really didn't matter to him. He was an elitist. Now, the other individual that I'd like to comment on is Russell Conwell, Baptist preacher in Philadelphia at Temple Baptist Church, out of which, through a night school process, emerged Temple University. Russell Conwell believed that everyone ought to gain wealth. And he made the statement that to make money honestly is to preach the gospel. And he did this largely on the basis of a lecture which he reputedly delivered himself some 6,000 times, called Acres of Diamonds. And he would go into a community hours, if not a day or so, before he was to deliver this public lecture. And while he was in the community, he would seek out what are the economic possibilities in this location. So that even though he gave the lecture 6,000 times, there are really 6,000 lectures. Because the illustrations for each lecture are germane to that community, though there is a general skeletal framework for the whole thing. But it starts out like this. It's a story that he's taking as a young man, that he's telling, of an experience that he had while on vacation. He was riding camels down the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, and he's being regaled by stories from the Arab guide. And he's heard so many stories that he doesn't want to hear another one. But all of a sudden, the guide throws his hat in the air, catches his intention, and then says, haven't you heard this from vendors in Tijuana or in Rome or somewhere? For my particular friends, I have this particular, well, not price in this case, but I have this particular story. And then he goes on. And he said, there was a wealthy farmer here in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley who had gained a considerable amount of wealth and was a very happy and a very satisfied man. Then one day there came to his home a priest. And the priest told him of the far greater wealth to be achieved in the discovery of diamonds. And when this is regaled to him, the farmer all of a sudden feels that he is tremendously impoverished. And he asks the man, "Where do I find diamonds?" And then the priest tells him under what conditions in the earth you will likely find the diamonds. Gets a lesson in what geology then. Good lesson in geology, you're always going to find the diamonds. So then he sells his farm converts all of his wealth, which is considerable, to cash, and heads off on a worldwide search for diamonds. Eventually, he uses up all of his resources, never finds the diamonds, and standing one day on the coast of Spain, despondently, looking into the waves of the Mediterranean, he jumps in and commits suicide. However, back home on the ranch in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, the man who has purchased the property is out cultivating one day and scratches up some rather shiny objects. And he finds this one particularly a beautiful thing, all the hues of the rainbow and everything, takes it home, puts it on his mantle. A few days later, the same priest comes by and notices this shiny rock, as it were, on the mantle, and asks the new owner where he got that, and he said, oh, he dug it up out in the field. And the priest tells the man, you have a diamond. So then, busily, the new farmer rushes out and cultivates his land with great care and uncovers what was supposed to be the largest diamond field in the world. Now, when Conwell tells this story, I think you can see the fable, the line at the bottom of the fable, and this is what he tried to impress upon the young people of America, and Conwell dies in 1925, so we're getting well into the 20th century. He tells the young men and sometimes young women that there is a tremendous future in America, and that future is in your own backyard. You don't go chasing wild dreams. The grass is not greener on the other side of the fence. You make use of every opportunity you have. But you may say, I'm not a creative person. I'm a dullard when it comes to that. And Conwell comes back. You do not have to be creative. All you have to be is perceptive. So he would tell a young man, go out from your house and walk in every direction, no more than 4 blocks, and look at the people. See what they need. And you'll discover that the needs of people are essentially simple needs. When you have seen the needs, come back home, create it, then manufacture it, and the wealth that will come to you will be staggering. He commented in the story, says, now take a look at young mothers with their little babies. Just think of the fortune that came to the man who thought of the idea of how to bend some little steel wires into the shape of a safety pin. Look at the money that was to be obtained of the one who had enough sense to put that little paper top on the milk bottle with a loop that you could pull it off. Think of the man who went into the business office and saw what a future there was to glue a piece of rubber on the end, on the unsharpened end of the accountant's pencil. This is where money is to be made. It doesn't take creative geniuses. It simply takes people that are perceptive to the needs. Then he would go on and say, don't go out and try and create a market there. Go out and attempt to satisfy the market that already exists. And this is how you will make money. And when you have made money, then see what you can do for society. And then you come up with the Carnegie thing again, the concern for the distribution of wealth. Once you have made it, then see what good you can do. One time he was asked in the lecture, in the question-answer period, is money the greatest thing in the world? And he responded, no. Love is the greatest thing. But fortunate the lover who has money. He said, notice what good you can do with money. It is the love of money that is evil, not the money. And so he preached Here then, while America was industrializing very rapidly, then in the 1870s, 80s, 90s, up beyond World War I, another 10 years, he was preaching that in this country, under these circumstances, an individual should work hard to accumulate, because it was with the accumulation of money that one then can do good, not only for himself, but that one can do good for all of mankind. Now this is the gospel of wealth. Now when I teach this to undergraduates at Augustana, I often ask them if they have any sympathies for this point of view. And I would say that over the last 2 or 3 years, they have returned to sympathies for this point of view. You go back 5 to 10 years ago, and the concern was not with this point of view at all. They were more concerned with what I'll be mentioning tomorrow in the social gospel. But there has been a change. The gospel of wealth advocates are coming back onto the scene again. And many of them will tell me that now that they're reaching the ages of 21 and 22 and about to graduate from college, that this is what their parents have in mind for them. Now they have had the advantages of the education, they ought to know how to work the economic system, and they ought to go and therefore make something of themselves. And especially at the present time at our school, we have many students who are the first generation college students, coming from European, South European, East European backgrounds, where the family has been low middle class, probably in the Gary steel mills or something like that. And it is expected of them, the first generation with an education, to really crack the good American middle class dream, as their grandparents and parents have saw it. And it is up to them then to become the material successes in life. And so they understand from the point of view of their parents and their grandparents, but they're beginning, I think, more to understand from within themselves this idea that money is to be made, because if you have money, then you can do good. And then once in a while, they'll tie it in with one of these biblical stories, like the stewardship one, and try to give a religious justification for what they are seeking to do. But I have to keep reminding them, with Carnegie, and I think also with Conwell, though it's not quite as strong with Conwell, because Conwell does not deal with a person who makes what Carnegie would say more than mere competence. The idea here is that the money is to be utilized during one's own lifetime, and that he is to see to it that it is distributed according to the ways that he thinks God would have him do. So I'm suggesting, emerging in the 19th century, particularly aggravated by the industrial situation, that this is, I would submit to you, a still major theme in popular pew piety. But that it doesn't stand alone, and often an individual is intermixed with such other major themes that we'll be coming to as we go through the week, such as the social gospel, or another major theme, revivalism, or the one that my teacher at the University of Chicago, Sidney Mead, 15 years ago, which he shouldn't have done as a historian, but prophesied would become the major thrust of American religion, and that today is expressed perhaps most noticeably on television by Robert Schuller of Garden Grove, California, the combination of wealth, health, and well-being, the concept of new thought that goes all the way back to the Civil War era and Phineas Quimby and Mary Baker Eddy and then Unity School of Christianity and on up the line Norman Vincent Peale and Oral Roberts and so on. That form of pew piety, or a fifth one that I would, or another one that I would suggest anyway, has to do with the crusades that American Protestants have been willing to engage in from time to time to not save the world for democracy, at least to Save America from the Bottle or other moral campaigns that have been carried on, that these are forms of pew piety that simply do not fit into the theological school's systematic concepts of the Word and will of God, but do reflect how people consciously and perhaps sometimes unconsciously as well, religiously reflect on the lifestyle that they are pursuing or that they wish they were pursuing or which they see the country as pursuing. If any of you have some comments, I'd be pleased to attempt to respond to them, or someone in the group can perhaps attempt, can respond better than I.
Do I understand correctly that the Conwell never himself acquired wealth, but that he produced his philosophy? Is that?
I would say that I ask our students when we, and those who are graduating, I said, now on the 28th of May, you're going to be forced to listen to two presentations. You're going to have a baccalaureate sermon by the professor of preaching at Drew Seminary, an alumnus of the school, and you're going to have a commencement address by Adlai E. Stevenson. Now, I say, I'm putting then a preaching professor and a United States Senator together, back to back on the same day. Is there going to be any difference in what they have to say? Are you going to hear the gospel of wealth? Are you going to hear the social gospel? Are you going to hear health, wealth, and happiness? What I'm saying, that Conwell would make probably a good commencement speaker, if we use the term of what is expected of them. Or he might make even a baccalaureate preacher, challenging people with their God-given duty, again, to paraphrase and contort the Old Testament, to care for the earth within this framework of caring, which really means to develop. To develop.
He asked, though, did he himself get real wealth?
No. Well, he made a if he would wanted to have, he could have. Because, of course, there was the fees that he charged for this lecture, and to give it 6,000 times, was going to come in. But he turned it all over to Temple. And on the basis of this, then, the university emerges out of what really was, started out as a parish night school to teach the reading, writing, and arithmetic to employees in Philadelphia. So he did not. He did not amass it and then give it away, as Carnegie did. He simply never amassed it. He gave it away as it came in. That type of thing.
I trust that Carnegie's tenet that one comes into the world poor, one should also leave it that way, didn't really catch on with the gospel of wealth, did it? I mean, are there other examples of, and he hardly left the world poor himself, but are there other examples that really became part of the gospel of wealth? That some sense of you can't take it with you?
No, there do not seem to be the indications.
Yeah.
Most families establish charitable trusts or something of that nature in which the name was perpetuated.
Yeah.
The Rockefeller certainly, as a group, still are a very wealthy family. Now, from Carnegie's point of view, it would have been fine if the Rockefellers were all wealthy, but each one of them would have had to have done it on his own.
Yeah.
He maintained that if a wealthy man leaves funds to a son, that he corrupts the son.
Yeah.
That wealth corrupts the son.
That's capitalism. I mean, at that point, he's more thoroughgoing than were the people who called themselves capitalists. Because true capitalism says that everyone starts at on the same line. And if the father makes a fortune, that father should not pass it on to the children.
No.
Because then they're not capitalists.
Now, Carnegie would come back, if I'm probably reading into him a little bit more Presbyterianism than I should, he wouldn't use the term capitalist so much there as he's used the idea of the elect. Are they really chosen by God to exercise this responsibility? And he thought wealth, inherited wealth, destroyed the integrity of the one who inherited. He also was extremely annoyed at the practice of Rockefeller to hand out shiny dimes when he was out walking. And he said it was an absolute waste of money. And Carnegie had no appreciation for what you and I would probably call is typical charity. Carnegie did not believe in any welfare programs, because he said money given in welfare only encourages slothfulness and laziness. He did not believe in any welfare programs. And one of his greatest critics was a man by the name of Jacob Riis, a Danish immigrant who came in the late 1890s and wrote a rather well-known book at the turn of the century called How the Other Half Lives, which was a study of the tenement district of New York. And of course, he decried what had happened to the immigrants that had to live in these tenements. But he and Carnegie were in universal agreement on the point that charity, by simply giving to the poor, is no good. Carnegie would say that 950 out of every $1,000 given in charity is wasted. And then he would come up with that biblical story that it would be better if a millstone were hung about the neck of the philanthropist who simply dispersed his money, and that he'd be cast into the sea, than he lead these 950 into greater sin. And Jacob Riis, in his analysis of the New York slums, said, Carnegie's right, that if money is given to the down and out and the poor, the vast majority of it ends up in the grog shop. So he said, so Riis agreed with Carnegie at this point that many individuals are incapable of handling it. So he called for some other form of reconstruction of society. Again, a kind of a form of paternalism. But that you just cannot give it to individuals. They simply are not able to have. Now, Bishop Lawrence of Massachusetts, the Episcopal bishop, who made this one-liner to the fact that 98% of the wealthy men in this country are wealthy because they're godly. Godliness is in league with riches. Lawrence, however, had a much more positive attitude toward the poor immigrant. He would say, look at these hangdog expressions of the Pole, the Czech, the Italian, when they arrive in Boston Harbor. But, he says, take a look at them 5 years later. Their shoulders are erect, their head is held high. They have made it. So Lawrence maintained the idea that one could easily rise above one's circumstances. Jacob Riis ended up very, very pessimistic. Carnegie was very pessimistic about the individual. So there was a variation there in how they assessed the individual. But the general conviction was that the individual has to have done for him, because he is not able himself to make the most judicious use of funds. Which meant to Carnegie, you don't pay any higher salary than you have to, because it will not be appropriately used. It will not be used to the advancement of the individual or the advancement of society.
That view, though, of management was really not uncommon to the giants of the day. They were theory X people, well, not theory Y people, that is, that they felt that the human being had to be pushed and cajoled, and they wouldn't naturally do things, do work by themselves, but rather that they had to be pushed into it and forced into it.
I think part of this is the reaction that you have in the latter part of the 19th century, which was general across America, in the aversion to what has become called the new immigrant in the 1880s, the Eastern European, the Southeastern European. That I don't think what you're saying really held true in the earlier part of the 19th century when you were dealing with the Anglo-Saxon Teutonic. These were considered ambitious people. These are the ones who could develop the Ohio-Mississippi Valley and so on. But see, Carnegie coming in, he's really dealing with a problem of the Anglo-Saxon Protestant white and the Polish immigrant, the Italian immigrant, the Czech immigrant, and it's kind of an economic clash. And Carnegie is holding on to the earlier 19th century America dream that this country is for Englishmen and Germans and Scandinavians, and it's not for all those Slavs who, in addition, are blighted Roman Catholics. You see, all this kind of comes into conflict here. Ralph.
Comments from a point of a biblical scholar of sorts. Would it seem that the passages that these guys use are from the pastors, which are kind of patriarchal in a very set up, or those when they quote Jesus, more or less Jesus seemed to the evangelists at a particular point. I've never checked that out. It would seem that the only pastor I'm searching, maybe others can find it, where you don't have that sort of patriarchalism in the New Testament, would be in Paul, where he lists the gifts of the Spirit, and where he speaks of among doing miracle workers, and also in chapter 12, the list of these functions as an administrator. I think it's Kubernetes business. Is there a new way in which a person might get a different slant from the New Testament?
Of course, you bring up that particular rich young man. Carnegie felt that he was really giving the interpretation to the story of the rich young man. Because he pointed out, now that the story of the rich young man, it was what the monasteries had used throughout the Middle Ages as sort of their key texts. And it's true, you go back to St. Francis of Assisi and other monkish leaders, that this is the text. Go, sell all that you have, give to the poor, and come and follow me. And Carnegie said, that's exactly what I have done. That's exactly what I've done. I've sold everything I have. I have given to the poor, that is, those who have the ability to help themselves. I provided the environment for this, and I'm literally following Jesus. That was one of the texts that he liked to use simply because it was brought up against him all of the time.
Would you say that it's true of the robber barons that at the point for those who were Christians and sought explicitly to relate this to their faith, that their understanding of stewardship focused on the distribution of the wealth that they had acquired rather than on the how of the acquiring?
They acquired according to the laws of economics. They distributed according to the laws of the gospel.
Yeah. Whereas
we come to the social gospel tomorrow, we see it's the you acquire according to the injunctions of the gospel.
Yeah. Has Carnegie got any proposal, ideas to help the poor people in terms of kind of state management so that the unable poor people can be benefited?
Yes, he would be very sympathetic, for example, to aiding a family in any distress. Or he would take care of people with physical problems and so on. Yes, he was sympathetic to those who obviously could not help themselves. Yes, crisis situations, those who are no longer able to work. Yes, that was different.
Is there any basic ideological proposal, like, like state enterprise to provide economic equality or?
No, equality is a word that he couldn't use, because he did not see all men created equal. He saw some men created as being favored by God and some were damned by God. And if you were healthy and vigorous, if you're healthy, you ought to be vigorous, and you ought to make it on your own. So he did not use the terms equality. He saw labor governed by the laws of the market, not by any other ideology. A man can sell his hands. He has to. And that has to be according to the laws of economics. He had no other ideology.
And no state functions. State has nothing to do with economic enterprise.
Yes. A state, the purpose of government is to secure the property that an individual accumulates. That is the function of the state. And then the wiser will then distribute. He said, now when you die, there are three things you can do with your surplus. You can leave it to your family. We've already said that Carnegie felt that injured a person to be left wealth. The second thing is you can leave it to the state. And he said, then it will be wasted, because the state does not have the means by which to properly distribute it. Therefore, the individual himself must distribute it. But now, at the same time, Carnegie had no objections to a very high inheritance tax. See, he would have no objections to that, because there ought to be nothing left anyway. Now, that would be a little different than with these trust funds and so on established. But Carnegie himself supported the development of the high inheritance tax. And it came, I think, shortly after his own death. But he was very supportive of a high inheritance tax. But the state does not really have a function. That is passing your responsibility to allow the state to do it. And he did not believe in the equality.
Sounds to me like
quality of opportunity, maybe, but
that sounds to me like the our congressmen and bureaucrats need to know a little more about Carnegie's philosophy.
Well, he did not have the greatest confidence in government administrating, but he had great confidence in governments protecting the sacredness of property. Now, when we come to the social gospel, we'll see quite a different point of view there.
I think especially of the welfare. Philosophy.
Yeah, his welfare was individuals, not the state. Individuals, not
our convention hotel had a partial statement on its marquee here a couple months ago. Money is the root of all evil. Everybody needs work.
Well,
it seems, that in the Lutheran Church there's kind of an avoidance of this accumulation of great wealth or trying to build up a large economic empire, that there's more of an emphasis on personal contributions, doing things with your hands, interacting with individuals. And you even made some comments that were somewhat critical of Carnegie, the way he treated people, treated them as machines or their How does that come about? Why is there this avoidance of the type of thing that that Carnegie seemed to emphasize?
I would not respond to that in a theological vein. I'd respond initially, at least, in a sociological vein. That the Lutheran community, at least until perhaps quite recently, has been a very middle class, quite heavily agricultural constituency. And it reflects that kind of a situation. And also, you'd have to take a look at the Germanic background, where the church does not become involved, basically, in economic problems. I mean, the church is a department of state in some sense. It deals with the spiritual, and the government deals with other aspects of life. Then you contrast that, for example, with the English-speaking world, where much of your creative social concerns that eventually become part of English law come out of the Anglican Church or some other religious body. that the church is seen as having a tremendous responsibility for the overall social life of the country. I don't think you find that in the German states. And I think that our Lutheranism in this country has tended to follow more the German pattern than the English pattern, where it's private charity. William Warren Sweet, probably the major developer of Christianity in America, made this comment once, that there is no major denomination as irrelevant to American society as the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And then would go on to say, and yet within that same group, there is a tremendous concern in looking after its own. And I've heard this said frequently. You take a look at Lutheran institutions, hospitals, orphanages, and so on. They are much more inclined to want to keep the name Lutheran than other Christian bodies with similar institutions. And so he could applaud Lutheranism for its individual concerns, but largely expressed within the family of the denomination. And I think there's a European background that in part accounts for this, and also for that strata in society that basically Lutheranism has occupied, so that it has not become politicized, but has dwelt very much on individual responsibility, individual contributions, even if this at times tends to be towards those of your own, towards your own denomination. The Americanization of Lutheranism hasn't yet matured. Still a bit of an alien body in the English world. Then tomorrow, I see our time has elapsed, so take a look at the social gospel. There are two individuals on a look here. One perhaps you have not heard of very much, and that is Walter Rauschenbusch, a Baptist, a very strong Germanic background. There's a lot of Lutheran theology in his theology of the social gospel. And the other one is the most popular fiction ever written in America in terms of publishing until the paperback world emerged in the 1950s, and that is Charles Sheldon's In His Steps, which is a panoramic view of American religion, but its central focus, though by no means its exclusive one, is social Christianity.